tucked in the back there. You know, men and women have long pondered over the relentless question, does my life have a real purpose and goal, or am I just here? And it's something that is increasingly a question in the postmodern mind, where the Judeo-Christian world and life view, the way of thinking things through biblically, continues to fade in our culture. But it's not a question that is asked just by modern men. It's asked by a pre-modern man, a man named Solomon. Perhaps the richest and wisest and the most beautiful man that's ever lived. A man who, one commentator said, has brains and bucks and beauty. And he ponders over the end of his life as it grows nigh unto him this day of reckoning with the Lord. He begins to wonder whether he really, in all of his wisdom, really understood what life is about. I can remember when I was a young fellow in college, I guess it was, maybe after college and arriving in the military, there was a popular singer in those days named Joni Mitchell, kind of a wisp of a little woman who was a folk singer. She wrote songs from, she didn't sing most of her songs, she wrote them for other people. One song that she wrote that was a number one hit song for Judy Collins was called Both Sides Now. This is how the lyrics went. Bows and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I could have done, but clouds got in my way. And I've clouds from both now, from thin down still now. The cloud illusions I call. I really don't know clouds at all. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, that dizzy dancing way you feel when every fairy tale comes to real. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go. If you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow. It's love's illusions, I recall. I really don't know love at all. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads. They say I've changed. Well, something's lost and something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose. And still, somehow, it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. You almost wonder whether Joni Mitchell read Ecclesiastes before she penned that poem, set it to music. Because that's exactly what Solomon is going to say throughout this book. And in that exact same order. He's going to not necessarily look at clouds, like a little girl lays in the summer grass and says, oh, there's a feather canyon. There's an ice cream castle. But he's going to look at the world scientifically. He uses the word examine. I'm going to examine the world around me and see if there's meaning, and I'm going to come to the conclusion that I really don't know this world at all. And then I'm going to try love. And I'm going to try it with a vengeance. 700 wives and 300 concubines. I'm going to know everything there is about a woman, sex, and love, and romance, and marriage. And I'm going to come to the conclusion, I really don't know love at all. And then I'm going to set myself to work, and to accomplish, and to build, and to accumulate. I'm going to become rich, and successful, and powerful, and influential. I'm going to be someone who uses every second and every ounce of my resources in life, and I will come to the conclusion that I really don't know life at all. It's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know the world and love and life at all. That is Solomon's message, or so it seems, as he examines his life and my life and your life under the sun. He is eminently qualified to do so. Look again at verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. The words of Kohelet, what it assembles the people together. You'll find the exact same word in verb form in 2 Chronicles chapter 5, where it says that Solomon assembled the people together to dedicate the temple and to preach to them. We have reason to believe that the kings in those days often assembled the people to teach and instruct and to give speeches like our kings and princes and governors do. And Solomon was one who often, and he's called himself the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. That means that this man is Solomon. No doubt about it. He's the one whose name means peaceful one. The one whom the Lord gave a nickname to, Jedidiah, beloved of God. Or literally, favorite of Jehovah. And this man, Jedidiah, I said, had brains and bucks and he had beauty. He was the wisest man in all of the scriptures, in all of the world, the Bible says. He was known for his, no pun intended, his proverbial wisdom. The author of all these proverbs. And his wealth, his bucks were absolutely spectacular. The scripture says in 1 Kings 10:23 that he was greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And he had beauty. Read the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon called Canticles. They describe him there. Tall. Muscular. The physique of one of these guys on the Bowflex commercials. He had long flowing black hair and big brown eyes and lips that were red and rich and rosy cheeks. And all the girls, all of them in Israel, fawned over him and loved him, desired him. He attained all those riches and all that wisdom and all that beauty because he asked God to make him a faithful servant. You remember the story that he was a young fella in his teens and he became king not because he wanted the job, and I think we need to keep that in mind that Solomon was a boy who never really intended to be king. He had an older brother too, actually, who were in line before him, and he just intended to kind of while his days away with his one fetish. Sports cars, or they called them in those days chariots, but the same thing. He wanted to own garages full of them, and he had them, and he liked to race them and run around in them, and that's all he wanted to do. And by the twist of God's providential hand, he found himself overnight to be king. So God came to him that night and said, Solomon, what do you want? And Solomon said, well, I want to be wise so that I can rule this kingdom and not lose what my father has gained. And then God said this, Behold, I have done according to your word. Behold, I have given you wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before, nor shall anyone after you arise like you. And I have also given you what you have not asked for, riches and honor, so that there will not be anyone among the kings like you in all your days or forever. This man was, more than any other man ever born, able to take hold of all the good things that life under the sun had to give us and try to answer life's most probing questions. And he comes to the conclusion that life under the sun without the God who lives above the sun is a waste of time. The book sounds cynical and pessimistic and negative. It's not. It's overwhelming as we read it. The number of our hearts to enjoyment and joy and pleasure and peace and the simple things of life calls us to remember God. But it doesn't begin that way. It begins in a way that is disconcerting. And as Solomon says, I want to talk in this introductory paragraph or two, verses 1, chapter 1, verse through chapter 1, verse 18, and talk about the endless cycles of life. He will talk about two things in these two paragraphs. He will talk about the futility of the secular world and the failure of secular wisdom to bring any meaning and joy and happiness to life. Let's follow his train of thought, thought by thought, as he unfolds this introduction to his book to you and me. He begins by talking about the futility of this world under the sun. Remember that that's the key phrase, not vanity of vanities. The key phrase is under the sun. That's the perspective he's looking from. From the eyes of a secular man to the secular world, he looks and he says that life in the secular world without God is futile. And he begins by talking about the futility of the world's purpose. Verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He uses a little word, hebel. H-E-B-E-L. Sometimes the B in Hebrew sounds like a B when it's pronounced. And he talks about this word, and he uses it 39 times. It's a key word in his book. Many people, because it occurs so often, think that that's the theme, and that's why the book picks up the negative reputation that it does. The theme is really life under the sun. But the word vanity occurs many times. It's a word that has five principal meanings. Each meaning has to be determined by the context. It can mean that which is brief and transitory or unsubstantial, that which will not last, is fleeting and has no real content, that which is vaporous, a breath, a mirage. And sometimes he uses it that way when he talks about chasing after the wind. It's also something that's used to mean unreliable or frail, something that's weak and predominantly human as opposed to the divine. Thirdly, it means that it which is futile or frustrating or has no effect or no results of hard work. So sometimes in the English translation, futility and vanity and frustration and emptiness are the words we use to translate that verse in that context. It can be that which is deceitful or stupid or worthless, that which promises something that it cannot deliver. One commentator translates this verse, verse 2, the meaninglessness of a meaningless life. And it can mean that. It can also mean that which is of no value whatsoever, that which is worthless, that which seems to sparkle, kind of like fool's gold or glass diamonds. But when you really put it under the fire and begin to examine it, it turns into sand and dust in your hand. Solomon uses that word vanity in all of those five meanings in this book. What's interesting, though, in this verse is that look how he pronounces that it's vanity, vanity. Vanity, vanity. He uses the singular of the world, vanity, and then the plural, vanities, like holy of holies, king of kings, lord of lords, song of songs, God of gods. That's the way that the Hebrew pronounces the highest superlative. When they want to use something in the superlative in Hebrew, they put it in the plural. So, for example, the name for God is really Elohim, which literally means gods. It becomes the superlative, meaning that El, God, our God, is Elohim. He's all that the gods together could or should be. He is the God of gods. When we want to double that superlative, we take the singular and add it to the plural. The vanities of the most vain. The God of all gods. The holy of the most holy place. And that is what Solomon does. Franklin Longman says the superlative is formed by the use of a word twice in a construct relationship, first in the singular and the second time in the plural, the singular being a possession of the second plural. Vanity of all that is most vain. In other words, it's the most stupid thing you can imagine. This life under the sun without God above the sun. Now, I want you to notice carefully what he says. He says all is vanity. And that's where people become thrown off the path with Solomon. It sounds like he's saying there's absolutely nothing in life worth your effort, worth your affection, nothing of value whatsoever. But that's not what he's saying. And he'll show that as he goes on through the book. He'll pull out those things, those gifts from God that are precious and need to be hung on to in this life and in the life yet to come. He uses the word all, meaning not everything, but life as a whole. Life as a composite, or as Michael Eaton says, all of the experience seen as a unit is subject to this accusation that at its very core, it is in of itself vanity, worthlessness, something that promises what it cannot deliver. The old Puritan Charles Bridge explains it this way. He redoubles his asseveration to show the certainty of it, and that is, all is an unmixed vanity in its highest degree. It's a vanity of vanities. Nor does it belong only to a part. Everything severally and all things collectively, all in one grand expanse, one vast heap of numberless perishing vanities. I affirm, Solomon says again and again, that there is nothing in this world but what is the vainest of vanity. All is therefore utterly inefficient for the great use of man's true happiness. It only enlarges his desire in the endeavor to gratify them, but leaves behind an aching void, a blank that it cannot fill up. Solomon proves that in his next point. He talks about not only the futility of life's purpose, but the futility of the world's profit. Look what he says in verse 3. What advantage, or some translations say, what profit? Some say, what gain? Those are all three legitimate translations. What advantage or gain or profit does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? This little word is yitron in Hebrew, and it's a financial accounting word. It's what is left over when the transaction is complete. It's the profit, or the residue, or the return on investment, or the savings that yields a return. It is what's left over when business is done. A man doesn't work for nothing. He doesn't live for nothing. He lives for a profit, for gain, for some advantage. And he says, what advantage, what profit, what gain does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Solomon says, when it's all said and done, and my life's work is over, and I look over my shoulder at death, what will I see under the sun? What will be my profit from all my work? Where's the reward, the return from all I've invested in this life? What is the residue when I take out all that I've lost and all that I've suffered and all that I've sacrificed and all that I've given and all that's been robbed from me by someone else? What's left over? What advantage is there? Well, he really doesn't say nothing. That's the implication. But that's the wrong implication. He will say there are things that are worth it. But life without those things, Solomon said, is bankrupt. Walter Kaiser says, nature and labor both have no residuum. That is, anything left over. There is no benefit, no profit, no increment, no principle of life or purpose inherent within nature or labor for man to hang on to. And in fact, it weighs heavily upon him and discourages him at the time of his death. You've heard the old cliche that you've never seen a hearse go down the street with a U-Haul attached. You can't take it with you when you go. But all you leave is in that casket in this world. That's what Solomon is reckoning with. Remember, he's talking about life under the sun. And he's saying there's really nothing worth all of your effort and all of your investment in life if it's something that you need to leave behind under the sun when you go to meet face to face with God who lives above the sun. He calls it in another place, striving after wind. He'll use that expression 9 times. Chasing something that is elusive and cannot be grasped hold of. He's not talking about the things we do for God. Luther is right when he says, Solomon is not dealing with the works of God which are good and true and above the sun, but the works that are under the sun, works that we carry on in this physical and in this earthly life alone. He's saying, when I look at things the way they are, I come to this conclusion. That which in life under the sun I think is really valuable, when tested by the fires of life, turns into vanity. And the things I thought were mean and insignificant of the Lord, they become precious when my life is ending and I'm ready to go meet the Lord. That's what he's saying. Jesus put it better. Jesus said, for not even when a man has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Paul put it this way, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain, not vanity, in the Lord. We find that difficult to believe because for us, walking by sight is always easier than walking by faith. And the world and the flesh and the devil, they have a way of dangling things out in front of our eyes that are instantaneous and can be measured and quantified and painted and insured and spangled up and put somewhere for everybody to see and go, ooh. But they're nothing. The things that really matter are the things that cannot be seen except by the eyes of faith. The old Puritan Matthew Henry says this, what profit has a man in all of his labor under the sun? All he gets by it will not supply the wants of the soul, nor satisfy its deepest desires, will not atone for the sin of the soul, nor cure its deep diseases, nor countervail the loss of it. What profit will they be to the soul in death, in judgment, or in everlasting states? The fruit of our labor in heavenly things is meat that endures to eternal life, but the fruit of our labor for the world is only meat that perishes.
and in the end is a striving after wind and the vanity of all vain things. And the psalmist illustrates that. He shows us why the world under the sun, how futile it is to go after the things in this world for your happiness. Look what he says in verses 4 through 11. He uses four examples in nature to show us about the endless cycles of futility and vanity in this life. He begins by talking about the earth. A generation goes, verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. He says one age comes and one age goes, one stock of kids are born and another one on the other end of the cycle drops off into eternity. And what happens to the earth? It remains the same. We think that things change. We talk about all of our progress, but he says, you know, we're not able to eliminate disease, to fend off death much longer than we have. We're not able to preclude national or natural disasters. We're not able to eradicate poverty like we say we're going to do in each generation, to redistribute the world's resources, to harness the power of the sun, to stop the power of war. We're not able to do these things. In fact, he says, hurricanes and tornadoes destroy, and avalanches bury, and famines strike, and pestilence plunders, and violence erupts, and resources run out. That's all happened in the last 6 months in the newspaper, in case you haven't noticed, in this scientifically advanced, progressive world. In fact, the more we work at it, the more we struggle with nature, and she just will not fight. Her mind says, it's going to remain the same. It's the sun. In verse 5. But also the sun, he says, rises in the sunset, and hastens to its place, and there it rises again. He says the sun seems to wear itself out. It revolves and it rotates, it spins and turns and runs from one end of the world to the other in 24 hours. In fact, the word he uses for hastens is the word in Hebrew, to pant. It runs so much that it stops at the end of the end. But it can't stop. It's on the other side of the world and it's got to run again. Around in circles it goes. God knows how many millions of years it's done this. And in the end, it goes nowhere. It comes back to where it started. The earth will run on this cycle until it burns out and burns up. And all it will have to show in the end for its course is nothing. It will be nowhere. Stuck in its own rut. Here he depicts the sun as weary. Weary to be running the same course, almost as if it's wanting to break out and go somewhere else. But it can't. It drags and crawls along through day after day and year after year, millennium after millennium, until someday it just goes out with a boom. And it's done. What about the wind? Look at verse 6. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular course, the winds return. He says, you know, they come off the Mediterranean and they turn south over the Negev. They pick up a hot blast of the furnace of the desert. They could go on down and fry Egypt, but they won't. They turn and come back on us towards the north. And they blast this day in and day out. Oh God, he says, maybe one day the wind would change and go north and pick up the cool northern Mediterranean and moisture of Russia and come down and refresh us. But it never does. It just keeps going around in circles. You spit into the wind this direction, wait long enough and turn this way, your face will get wet. Things just keep going around. And what he says about the water. The waters, he says, all the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. Gravity and evaporation and condensation take place. The water never really goes anywhere. We learned that from ninth grade science, didn't we? That matter never really dispels, it just changes forms. And this matter goes from liquid to vapor to liquid again. And it just keeps going around. It falls in the river. The river goes downhill and keeps going down until it goes into the sea. The sea evaporates, the water goes up, comes over that wind, falls on the ground, and just keeps going around monotonously. Never when you want it. Always,
always after you've washed the car, never when the garden needs it. But it comes, its own cycle, and when it's all said and done, there's no more or no less water today in the world than there has ever been since the beginning of time. All that activity for nothing. You say, well, I'm not sure it's for nothing. Well, it is if I say so. No, I mean, it is if Solomon says so. Solomon says, look, what he's trying to illustrate is these things that are blessings can turn into curses. Remember that after Noah got off the ark, God said this, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and day and night shall not cease from the earth. Those are blessings on the one hand. We can count on the sun coming up and running its course, the wind blowing, the water falling, the earth giving forth its produce. But those things that are blessings also become monotonous, wearisome things because they never cease. They never change. And when we seek with all of our scientific secular knowledge to get a little more water, to take too much water from here and take it over there, to make the wind blow a little bit different to refresh these people, to make this ground more fertile than that ground so that these people aren't starving while these people are wasting, we're not able to do it. I mean, how many times have you thought, seriously, what it would be like to take places that are having monsoon rains and pipe that water to the desert and solve all the problems of those people? And after all these thousands and thousands of years, nothing changed. Nothing will. We're not going to fix it. Not us. Solomon says, what's more, we have to face the fact that we're looking at the same things over and over and over again. Verses 8 through 10. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. Man can't explain it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. For that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. I mean, is there anything of which one might say, see this, it is new? Already, it has existed for ages, which were before us. He says, the facts of the matter are, as we fight against all these evil things, and we think we make progress, and Solomon says, I'm telling you, we don't. Oh, yes, we do, we say. And Solomon challenges us. It's right in our face and says, well, then, what about AIDS? They used to call that the plague. And what about being gay or lesbian? You're shocked that that's around. Well, it was popular in Rome and Athens and Nineveh, Sodom and Gomorrah. In fact, we used to call it sodomy. We didn't call it being happy gay. We called it what it was, sodomy. And what about peace in your time? How come it is, people in the modern world, that more people will die in wars and be persecuted for the cause of Christ in your 20th century than all the centuries before? And what about women's liberation? You shocked that it's around? Well, it's been around before. I think it began on maybe the second day of creation. It began in the fall. Go back and read Genesis 3. You talk about your sophisticated philosophies and your progress of religion. You go to college and study comparative religions, how they're all merging towards one. And you fail to realize that there are more people bowing down to more idols, sacrificing more infants to the god of modernity than ever before, and than you've ever been. So things that were before are still here, and that which you think is going to be new is really old. It all keeps coming around. And there's the pain and rub and the frustration of it all. For all our grand efforts, we're not really even making progress in our souls. The more we change, the more we really remain the same. Locked in this vacuum, this cycle of returning to the same problems and sins. To cap it all off, icing on this foul-tasting cake is the fact that nobody seems to remember these things. Look at verse 11. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come still later. Solomon says what tops it all off is we forget how soon people forget. How
how quickly history becomes ancient history. Now, things that we went through when we were in college mean nothing to our kids now who are just coming into college. Let me prove that to you. This is amusing, but it's amazing at the same time. And there's a little college in Beloit, Wisconsin called the South Beloit Community College. And every year, the faculty, actually the administration, makes up a list from computers that they give to the faculty about the new freshmen who are coming into the freshman class. This is what they put out this year. This year, the class that is entering the college freshman year were born in 1980, and this is what's true about them. They can remember virtually nothing about Ronald Reagan and George Bush. In fact, in most of their memories, the only president they've ever had is Bill Clinton. Now, that's enough. That's enough for them to eat Ecclesiastes and say, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. For them, there's only been one pope in all of their life. One pope. I remember four. They remember one. John Paul II. The Cold War is not Emory. The Soviet Union fell in when they were 11 years old. They have never been afraid of a nuclear war, and they have never seen communism as the evil empire, only as a decaying old system that didn't work. Nothing to be afraid of. Their life has always included the threat of AIDS. The expression, "you sound like a broken record," means nothing to them. When they were 6 months old, CDs came out and record players have gone. They have always had caller ID, that's scary, answering machines, pocket calculators, and home computers. They've never had a black and white television set. They've never been limited to 13 channels, and they've never had to get up and go across the room to see what's on the next channel. They've lived with remotes for everything, you know. They cannot, now this is shocking, but this is true. They can never remember a McDonald's Big Mac coming in a styrofoam container. Remember, we thought that was big. You got out of the paper wrapping and you got in styrofoam, the cats won that old stuff. They're into this high-tech cardboard now. M&Ms were never beige in color. What are you talking about? Brown and beige, those have always been red and blue and green and assorted colors. And usually on campus, they're in the colors of your school. Except they get to develop a gray M&M, and I'm greatly distressed over that. Listen to this. They can never remember a host of the Tonight Show other than Jay Leno. Isn't that a tragedy? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, men, for them is a football player. They don't even know there was a basketball player by that name. Popcorn has always been in the microwave. They've always had MTV. They think Michael Jackson has always been white. They don't chuckle when, they do not chuckle when you say, "Where's the beef? I can't believe I ate the whole thing," or "Excuse me." They don't remember those things. Most of you didn't either. They think that Kansas, Chicago, America, Boston, and Alabama are places, not groups that sing songs on the radio. They wonder what all the excitement is about the Titanic being found, because for them it's never been lost. They can't fathom three things. Not having remote controls, what a TV dinner is, or most of their friends having just one mom and one dad who've always been married. That's my Abigail group, college freshmen. But you don't have to go across the generation. Jane and I were in London on Easter Sunday, and we're walking down, and we turned the corner, and there was a sign that said, Carnaby Street. I said, Jane. We're on Carnaby Street. We're on Carnaby Street. And Jane said, "What's Carnaby Street? How many here remember Carnaby Street? It walked you by. Carnaby Street, listen, that's where the Beatles began to record. That's where the model Twiggy was introduced to the world. That's where the mod British pop rock. That was the mecca of, that was Kate Ashford before the hippies ever dreamed of being weird. It was all happening in Carnaby Street. And everybody who was in high school in my age dreamt of going to Carnaby Street and hanging out. They were not impressed with this old baggy 50-year-old man and his wife who didn't know what the significance. But I figured, man, it's amazing how things change. And how many years older are you than me?
4 years younger, and she doesn't realize it. See how quickly things change. And Solomon says, look, when we work so hard to accomplish all these things, achieve all of our victories, make all of our advances and all of our inventions, by the time our children come along, they say, so what are we after? He says, look, maybe I'm being too hard on life. Maybe I'm not being fair. So let's explore. And he introduces in verse 11 the first of four sermons, four sections in this book of Ecclesiastes, where he will explore life's possibilities and life's rewards and life's meaning through different venues. He will explore through wisdom and through pleasure and through wealth. And here he begins the section where he talks about wisdom. He introduces it, and he says, look, the guy with all the brains and all the bucks and all the beauty will look at wisdom and see if what the world knows can give us answers that make us happy. In these verses, verses 12 through 18, he divides that paragraph into two parallel sections. He first talks in both of these sections about his qualifications to make his statement. He makes his observation and then encapsulates it in a proverb. He does that twice. And he's talking about the frustration and failure of secular wisdom. He says secular wisdom fails because it fails, first of all, in that it cannot fix what is broken. Verses 12 through 15. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set in my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. And I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. For what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Now here's the first failure of secular wisdom. It cannot fix things when they're broken. Once again, he identifies himself. This is the second time. In the first chapter, he identifies himself as the man qualified to speak like this. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. That past tense does not mean, as some liberal commentators want to say, this man was king, but now is no longer king. He's simply using the perfect tense, which Walter Kaiser is correct in saying, the perfect tense actually denotes a state of action that began in the past and stretches forward. Only in Leahy did it say that. He carefully hit that about the time of the word, and that was the way the author wanted it to be in chapter 1, verse 12. I have been for a long time, and I continue to be, the king in Jerusalem, and I've had a lot of experiences. I know what I'm talking about. I've had all this opportunity to explore with my mind the meaning of life. Look at verse 13 and 14 again. I set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under the sun. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. He said, I set my mind and put all my vast resources behind this scientific exploration. I'm going to delve into the meaning. I'm going to ask why and how and when to everything possible. I'm going to find the key in this exploration, this scientific knowledge. And I've come to the conclusion, it's rough, grievous, or literally evil, or unpleasant, this task that God has given to man. It's grievous not only due to its unpleasant realities, but also to its unsatisfactory results. Because after all this exploration, I summarized all that I found in one succinct proverb, verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. What is crooked morally and physically and socially, what is sinful and damaged and dysfunctional, cannot be set right. It's an impossible task. I can't make sinners into saints. I can't make deformed people whole, unhappy people happy, and dying societies live again. With all of my exploration, I have come to the conclusion that the world in which I live in is irreparably broken.
and men can't fix it. Not only that, what we need to fix it, we haven't got. Look at the second part of the proverb. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. We need things that we don't have in this world to set it straight, to make it right. We're offering solutions with half of the resources. And no wonder they're not working. No wonder after all these thousands, and I don't know how long you believe men have been on the earth, 4,000, 10,000, 100,000. Doesn't make any difference for tonight's discussion. But after all this time and all of our vast wisdom and resources and sciences, you know what? We still can't figure out what causes and cures the common cold. We can't make cancer go away. We can't fool with the genes to make insanity something of the past. We can't preclude birth defects. We don't even know what a viral infection is, let alone treat it. What about rebellion in young people? Why do we know it's going to happen almost on schedule? And then they do it. And all of our great psychological and therapeutic techniques don't seem to work. They still rebel. Why are the hearts of men such that they leave their wives and their four children for some bimbo with the brains of a gnat and the morals of an alley cat? And we can't talk sense into the guy. We haven't been able to do it for a million years. What about war and racism and gender conflict and sexual perversion? Why, in spite of all of our great preaching and teaching, do men in America go after more false gods than they've ever gone after before? Why? Why is it so broken? And we can't fix it. Why, after Assyria and Babylon, Persia and Greece and Rome and Nazism and communism, why is this twit over in Serbia doing what he's doing? Why can't we talk sense to these people and realize that there's a better way to solve their promises and their problems and their difficulties than some Holocaust, some ethnic cleansing, some new captivity and rape and plunder, as barbaric as it's ever been? Why can't we fix that? Someone says, I don't know. I just know it's broken beyond repair. Not only when you begin to count up the things we need, we don't have enough stuff to get it done with. There's a second thing I'll tell you about the worldly wisdom, too. Not only does it fail to fix what is broken, it fails to really understand the ultimate problem. It really can't fathom things when all is said and done. Verse 16. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed the wealth of wisdom and knowledge. There's the third time in this chapter he identifies himself as the man qualified to talk about what he's talking about. He says, I'm the wisest man that ever lived. I am more educated than any before me or after me on this throne. I have vast resources that are absolutely unparalleled. My library, my science, my philosophers and theologians and laboratories and projects and experiments and thousands of hours of meditating and writing and inculcating these things in my brain. I've done more than any man before me and probably after me to try to think through the philosophical problem of life. And here's what he says in verse 17. I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realize that this also is striving after men. Nine times he'll use that phrase, striving or literally chasing the breath. I can't figure it out. Other people have copied his ideas. The old rock and roll group Kansas talked about dust in the wind. A guy who was one of these flower children of mine, a guy named Donovan, talked about chasing the wind. It was a Solomon of our own time. Old Bob Dylan asked this question and came to the same answer in his classic song. How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? And how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times does a man look up before he can see the sky? And how many ears must one man have before he hears people cry? And how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. the answer is blowing in the wind. How many years can a mountain exist before it's washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? And how many times can a man turn his head pretending he just doesn't see? The answers, my friend, are blowing in the wind. The answers are blowing in the wind. Bob Dylan said it. Solomon said it. The answer's out there somewhere swirling around in the wind. And we chase it. Never find it. We can't fathom it. We can't understand it. And so he comes to this bottom line, another proverb, verse 18, and here's what he says. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. I come to understand this, that the more we seek the answer, the more frustrating and painful it gets, because the more I know about God's world, the less I know what I need to know. And I know that. And it's frustrating. Charles Bridges says, the more we know, the more we shall be discomposed by the consciousness of ignorance, the disappointing results of all of our favorite theories. All of our favorite theories. All of our answers. Boys can't do math. Let's try the new math. We did that for about 6 years, and I couldn't add one and one to make two. It was hard to learn how to read. Well, let's do sight reading. Let's not use phonics. You know how that worked out. Duh. You know, they couldn't pass the exam to get out of high school, so we're going back to phonics. People have problems with alcohol. Well, let's not make them feel guilty. Let's declare it a disease and tell them that they'll never be free from it. They just got to cope. And if kids are rebellious, give them an open classroom. If drugs are a problem, legalize it. If people are getting AIDS, then pass them out condoms and tell them to be safe as they take death into their own bosom, as Proverbs says. And we got all these favorite theories, all these psychologically, sociologically, economically warped ideas. They never seem to work. But we keep on looking. We're going to find the answer. And Solomon says, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time. But you won't believe me anyway. Because that which has been is that which will be. And that which will be has always been before. And that generation knows. They remember what went before, even failures of their fathers. That's a pessimistic picture to begin to paint. Trust me, it gets better. It begins, this Solomon does, by saying, if there's going to be any answers in life, you're not going to find them in the world. Now that's hard for us to realize, but hear me again. This is not Mycroft, this is Solomon. This is God speaking to Solomon. The problems in the world will not be solved by solutions found in the world. Solomon's answers lie between the lines of these truths that he gave us tonight. If you got a pencil, write these down. If there's nothing but nothing under the sun, then our only hope must lie above the sun, with God. If there's nothing but nothing that's vain under the sun, then our only hope must lie above the sun, with God, where God is. If man who has everything and investigates everything visible in every way possible and finds nothing, then the answers must be found in that which is invisible. Not in this world. With God. If you investigate everything visible and find no answers, then the answer can't come from the visible. It has to come from the invisible. It has to come from God. Thirdly, if life's patterns are governed by a set of higher laws, then the control of the universe is not found in understanding these laws and controlling them, but understanding the lawgiver and being controlled by him. The answer is not in the laws of nature, but in the lawgiver of nature, God. Fourthly, this world is so broken that creatures absolutely cannot fix it, then we'd better look to someone who's not a creature to fix it. We'd better look to the Creator, to God. If the creatures can't fix the creation, then maybe we better turn to the Creator who made it to fix it and look to God. Fifthly, if our reason leaves us without answers, but just more questions, then we ought to not look to reason for answers, but to divine revelation. Not to men, but to God. That's what Solomon is driving after in every single verse of this wonderful little book. That under the sun, there's absolutely nothing that's worthwhile, no hope. If there's anything that's hopeful and worth anything, it comes from above the sun, not under the sun. In a very subtle way, Solomon has done something in these first 18 verses. He's talking about all the problems of life, but you notice, even though God is mentioned 50 times in these 12 chapters, he's only mentioned once in the introductory section. Only once. And that is in verse 13. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Solomon has showed that in looking for answers, if the only thing we see about God is that he frustrates us, then maybe we're looking for answers in the wrong place if we look for answers without God. Therefore, if there's going to be an answer, something that's not vanity is vanity, something that's not striving after wind, it's got to come from God himself, invading our world under the sun. And that's what the Bible teaches. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers, in the prophets and in many portions and in many ways, in these last days, he has spoken to us in his Son. He's spoken through theophanies, where he's shouted out of the clouds, and come in thunder and rain, and fire in a bush, and presence of an angel, and Shekinah glory, a pillar of smoke and fire. He's spoken through all the great prophets and priests and patriarchs. Came down on the mountain, spoke with Moses face to face, and in the last days he came down in human flesh in the God-man, the Jew, Jesus Christ, and spoke to us. And that's what Solomon is pointing towards. But there comes a time when men like Solomon, all those who live under the sun, after all they fought for and figured out and frustratingly wrangled about, they just get so frustrated. But one day they just hang their head as the sun blisters their back and the wind chased their face and the water is black and it makes them thirsty and the world is hard and see men. And they just throw down their tools and begin to weep only to hear a voice. And to look up and find the most strange and wonderful of all men, this Jesus Christ, standing in their bodies under the sun, on their earth that never changes, this precious Jewish air blowing in the breeze that goes round and round and round, little droplets of the water that will evaporate from his sweat and become the life-giving water to someone else in the world, under the same blazing sun that runs its endless course in a wearisome pattern. And he's there, under the sun with us, to give us the answers, provide the keys, to give us the tools to understand our life under the sun and above the sun, and to live that life so that we're ready to have joy in this life and glory in the next. God has punctured through that barrier. He's come, as the philosophers say, from the noumena to phenomena. He's come through the unreachable expanse of nothing into our world, in our time, in our flesh, to labor under our sun with us. And John and his best friends, those early disciples, they knew that. They listened to this glorious truth. Listen to what they say about him under the sun, this God-man. What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we beheld and our hands handled concerning the word of life, and the light was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us, which we have seen and heard we proclaim to you also, that you also may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ, and these things we write so that your joy may be made complete. This thing that is unknowable, untouchable, unfathomable, has come in a body that can be grabbed a hold of, that can be kissed and listened to and seen in our own talk, in our own world, in our own sweat and blood, taking our own death upon it. God has come down under the sun and said, there is an answer. The answer in this life and for the life to come is in my Son, the God-man, Jesus Christ. You want to be happy in this life? Think like, act like, live like Jesus Christ. And if you want to go and be with God in the next life above the sun, surrender to Jesus Christ and let Christ live His life in your body. Be crucified with Christ so it is no longer you who live, but Christ lives in you. And then life under the sun will make sense. For Paul is right in Colossians when he says, in Jesus Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Life begins to make sense when we look at the paradigm of Jesus Christ. Life begins to have value when Jesus Christ becomes the pattern of living. And life is not vain and frustrating and futile and hopeless when Jesus Christ becomes the promise of a life above the sun that will go on forever. It's true. It's life's illusions we recall. We don't really know life at all. But this God in human flesh is no illusion. He is a real thing. And Him we can recall. Him we can receive. Him we can experience a new life with. A life with a purpose in a purposeless world. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity except what is in Jesus Christ under the sun. Amen? Let's pray. Father, what a great God you are. To not lead us through the futility and frustrations and failures of an endless life of hopes that never materialize, answers that never work, solutions that always fail. You invaded this world ours. And blessed you, they say, literally eyeball to eyeball. You've kissed us on our lips.